So without further ado, let me introduce our three panelists for this evening. And we will be going in alphabetical order. And the first of them is, and I'll introduce all three and then they can go forward with their comments. The first of them is Dr. Sidney Drell, my good and longtime friend. Dr. Drell is a distinguished physicist at Stanford University. Some of you may have seen the item in the Mercury News the other day. He's just been awarded the Enrico Fermi Award by President Clinton for distinguished contributions over his career in not only the area of physics, but also in the area of arms control and national security. Sid Drell was for many years deputy director of the Stanford Linear Accelerator Center and is just a very distinguished member of both the physics community and the arms control community. Next to him is Larry Korb. Larry is the vice president and director of studies at the Council on Foreign Relations in New York. He is a longtime defense policy expert who you will see writing many articles in major journals and op-ed pieces in newspapers. He was director of the Center for Public Policy Education at the Brookings Institution. He was dean of the Graduate School of Public International Affairs at the University of Pittsburgh. He's been a professor of management at the U.S. Naval War College, and he's also served in a senior position in the Pentagon. A recipient of many awards and medals, and also author of many publications on defense and national security. And finally, last and certainly not least, Jim Woolsey. Jim is currently a partner at the law firm of Shea & Gardner in Washington, D.C. He returned to the firm in January of 1995 after serving for 2 years as the director of Central Intelligence, the Central Intelligence Agency. So with that, we'll ask Sid, Larry, and Jim to each make a series of comments and then go to your questions. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Gloria. I want to discuss what are, to me, important factors in arriving at a decision of what to do about national missile defense. This is our third real major public debate on this. It seems to occur like the cicadas or the 17-year locusts that come back every 17 years, or the moon in its phases once a month. This comes back every 16 years, I figured out, because in 67, Secretary McNamara raised the possibility of an anti-Chinese ABM. In 83 with Star Wars, and in 1999, after the analysis of the growing threat by the Rumsfeld Commission, we're on it again. And you can ask, why is it keeps coming back? Well, the reason is because it really is a very profound issue, because it touches to a basic instinct of human beings. Are we going to defend ourselves, our families? Can we defend ourselves, our families, or not? Up until the nuclear age, this always was a very important responsibility of our governments. And the issue has taken a very different form in the nuclear age, because whereas one could defend oneself by having attrition exacted on an attacking air force in World War II, and the British won the Battle of England with a 10% attrition rate on the Luftwaffe, when the first nuclear weapon hits, you're gone. And so you have to talk about an almost perfect system if you're going to get any protection. It also is important to revisit the question because the strategic situation has changed. In previous debates, we were in a Cold War with a major power like the Soviet Union that could match us resource for resource. And so the conflict, the competition was one in which it wasn't just technology, but it was resources against resources with measures, countermeasures, and countermeasures. That's different now because we're talking about, in the post-Cold War, primarily a limited defense against countries that are just beginning to become capable of long-range missiles with nuclear or biological weapons. And so it's a very different technical challenge. And then finally, there are technological advances, and one has to ask, is the balance between offense and defense changing at all in these times? The technical advances are that we no longer talk about putting a missile with a nuclear warhead making a big explosion in space. We're talking about hitting a bullet with a bullet, something that one indeed can do. But there are still technical realities because the problem in real world is not just hitting a bullet with a bullet. You have to wonder what the attacker has done to hide his bullet. Has he made his bullet look like a decoy and have lots of decoys accompanying it? Has he made false bullets look like bullets accompanying it? So you have countermeasures, you have anti-simulation, making the warhead look like the decoys. You have you can break the payload up, fractionate it into a lot of little bomblets, particularly containing biological weapons instead of nuclear, and the casualties are horrific when you think about it. Secondly, you, as I said earlier, you need to have effectively 100% defense. That's a very hard task, and these are technical realities we have to face and keep in mind throughout this discussion. We also mustn't forget in making the discussion that we have to worry not only about ballistic missiles, but all means of delivery, whether it, the nuclear weapon or the bugs come in a bale of marijuana, or in a ship in a harbor, or in short-range cruise missiles, or Piper Cubs, all of which are available. We have to also recognize that what we do will affect other countries and how they react, whether how will the Russians react to our deployment of a missile system, how will the Chinese react, how will the North Koreans, Iran, or Iraq react. Now, we do know that NATO countries have expressed concern. They're loath to just give up the ABM treaty, period. There are issues there. Simon Lund, the Secretary General of the NATO Parliamentary Assembly in Berlin this past week, this issue was raised and there were concerns. They worry about whether this will make us Fortress America if we have the defense. Or, on the other hand, you have to look at it, if we have a defense, will it provide protection for them or increase our resolve to protect them? These are issues. The Russians have not been interested in seeing us walk away from the ABM treaty, and we have to worry about them, because when we look about the, talk about the threat of nuclear weapons, it would be nice to have cooperation of other countries like Russia or China in helping prevent the spread of those nuclear weapons to the new countries of concern, you formerly called the rogue states. And so we have to act in a way in which we would like diplomacy to make it a cooperative move and have their support to try and prevent proliferation of weapons of mass destruction. These are issues. In fact, I often refer to Andrei Sakharov, the great Russian human rights leader, former, and father of the hydrogen bomb. And in reviewing his stands, as we did last year on the 10th anniversary of his death, you find that in his last press conference, not an interview before his death 10 years ago, now 11 years ago, he said he thought against a limited threat from a new country, it was technically realistic to have a some protection against a very limited threat. But then what he always emphasized, and that's what I want to emphasize here, is that you don't do things unilaterally. When you look at what you're doing, you have to look at the context. And in Sakharov's words, having, first of all, recognizing you cannot escape deterrence in a nuclear age. You can get some protection, but you'll never get full or complete protection against someone who is determined to deny that. We live with deterrence. We've lived with it for 55 years. He also emphasized throughout in his writings the importance of diplomacy. Diplomacy has always been a part of our national security, but when we live in a world where the use of the weapons available to us means really literally suicide, the dimension of diplomacy has never been more important than it is now. He also talked about the importance of cooperation. It's another form beyond diplomacy, building trust, openness, and working together, and finally making sure that countries whom you're dealing with, and during the Cold War, because he was thinking of the Soviet Union, you have to not behave in a way which denies them of what he called strategic parity, but what we call in the present world, you can't make them feel threatened, because they will define what is the threat to their deterrent ability, their security themselves. And we have to worry about China, and which has a very limited deterrent now. How would they respond to preserve their deterrent? And if they build up, what's going to happen in Japan? What's going to happen in India? What's going to happen in Pakistan? Are we going to go through that whole cycle of a major arms buildup? So these are all very important factors that we have to keep into account, and as we try and prevent the development of a threat to us. If we're going to make a step, then we also have to be clear what our goals are. Escaping deterrence, I submit, best technical judgment I have, that's impossible. That the level of damage that can be done to us with nuclear weapons, I think, will always be unacceptable if they are used. eventually, maybe in terms of dealing with rogue countries, perhaps you can delay that day, and therefore that's a different problem than dealing with Russia and China, I submit. How do we protect ourselves? And dealing with the new regional powers, their interest and most interests around the world, if you see it, if you look in the Mideast or the Russian southern border, tactical missile defense, defense against short-range missiles with non-nuclear warheads, that's something that's real. That's something we saw during the Desert Storm. I'm not talking about that now, and what the debate now is about is strategic missile defense, intercontinental range defense, moving much more rapidly, being armed with weapons of mass destruction. How will what we do affect if we make a step? How will it affect our efforts at nonproliferation? I've mentioned that already, trying to prevent the danger from developing if we don't have cooperation, because cooperation among the world powers will be essential for preventing nonproliferation. And then there are other forms of defense besides the national missile defense that this administration has delayed the deployment of. We get into technical issues like boost phase intercept. We'll leave that for the discussions. I believe that that is an area where it's very scenario specific, and in my view, boost phase intercept, which has to operate far away from our country within seconds of the initial deployment, looks better the less you go into details of it. But let's save that for the discussion. I'm not an enthusiast of that as an escape. So let me summarize. What do I recommend? I would say we're not yet at the technical point of making a deployment decision. We have to be realistic, as the law of the land says, do things that are technically sensible, not rushed by a schedule or a timetable. We don't want rush to failure. Maybe the most immediate threat that has been identified in the recent intelligence community reports, namely North Korea, maybe we're on the way to preventing that from being developed as a result of diplomatic efforts initiated by Secretary of Defense, now Stanford Professor Bill Perry, and talks now going on. So I think that's an example of where diplomacy and prevention have a lot to offer. We have to do sensible R&D, and we have to assume our leadership in the world as a country that's called for reducing nuclear danger, has led in the nonproliferation efforts signed by 185 nations around the world, and make good on some of the commitments, I believe, of the nonproliferation treaty, such as stopping the testing of nuclear weapons and getting on and ratifying a comprehensive test ban treaty to which we are committed by the nonproliferation treaty. Thank you.
I wish my name began with an A, B, or C, so I could have gone before Dr. Drell here. There's not much left to say. In thinking about this, I was reminded of a story I heard a couple of weeks ago down in Florida, and it seems that these two mature ladies were sitting in the leisure village, and one said to the other, "I've got news for you." The other one said, "What's that?" She said, "I'm going to get married again." He said, "At your age, does he have a lot of money?" She says, "No, all he has is his Social Security." She said, "Is he good looking?" She said, "He's kind of plain." Somewhat sheepishly, the other one said, "Well, he must be a great lover." She says, "As a matter of fact, we haven't made love yet." She says, "Why are you doing this?" To which the other replied, "Because he can drive at night." Now, this national missile defense better have a lot of money, be good looking, be a great lover, because, as Dr. Drell said, this has to do better than most weapon systems we build, and we're not there yet. I'll bet you we'll be here, if the good Lord spares us, 16 years from now, talking about still trying to work out these problems. Now, I'm just going to give you a few things to think about as you go through this debate, maybe to understand it. First of all, there's a political dimension. Having worked for President Reagan, I saw this firsthand. For Republicans, national missile defense is a litmus test of loyalty to the Reagan legacy. It's the foreign policy equivalent of abortion. It was the only weapon system mentioned in the contract with America. It's the only weapon system that Governor Bush has mentioned. And so it's not just another weapon system. It's something they have to have. And as soon as they got power back in the Congress, they began adding money to it. passed this law in 1999. It said it was the policy of the United States. And if Governor Bush is elected to the presidency, you can be sure this is going to be at the top of the agenda. There's also a diplomatic thing to think about, and Sid mentioned this. It's interesting to me why nobody else supports this, not just our strategic competitors, even our allies don't support it, and I think that's something you have to think about as you make this decision. There's also a moral dimension, if you will. I mean, the United States, as Professor Nye at Harvard said, leads the world not only because we have hard power, military and economic power, but we have soft power. And if we unilaterally abrogate the anti-ballistic missile treaty and go ahead with this without the support of our competitors and our allies, it's going to undermine our moral position, particularly when most of those who support going ahead with this don't want to ratify the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty. We have not ratified the International Criminal Court. We have not ratified the Landmine Treaty. So I think this will just be one other step in undermining our moral authority in the world. And then finally, it's the cost. Gloria talked about the fact we may have to spend, you know, up to $160 billion. But stop and think of this. If you put it in today's dollars, since Ronald Reagan gave that speech in 1983, we spent $100 billion, and what we have is nothing. Thank you.
Well, I was honored when the Commonwealth Club asked me to be with you this evening, but to tell the truth, since I'm A, lawyer, B, from Washington, D.C., and see, I spent some time out at the CIA. I'm pretty well honored to be invited into any polite company. Let me deal quickly with really three points. Is anything but politics driving this thing? Deterrence has worked in the past. Why shouldn't it still be our only option? And is the Clinton administration system headed in the right direction? First of all, is anything but politics driving it? I think, yes, there is. What's driving it is that the path of technology and time, we're more than 50 years past the invention of both ballistic missiles and weapons of mass destruction. If you take back to bacteriological and chemical, of course, they were way before that. And the trade in the technology of all of these has expanded around the world. Some of it spawned from Russia and China, some of it North Korean selling to Iran, various countries selling to Iraq. The availability of ballistic missile technology and of nuclear and certainly of bacteriological is just much, much greater in some very unpleasant places in the world than it was a few years ago. Now, that's a shame. It's something we can all regret, but it's something that we should not blink at. It is, I think, crystal clear, not only to the Rumsfeld Commission, but which I served on, but to anybody who looks at this issue objectively. Now, even if that is the case, you might say, even if, as the U.S. government says, North Korea may well have an intercontinental ballistic missile and weapons of mass destruction within the next 5 years or so, Iran within the next 10, Iraq within the next 15, and others to follow, Syria, Libya, whatever. Even if that's the case, you might say, look, we've just been through 45 years of a Cold War in which both sides had ballistic missiles and weapons of mass destruction, and we deterred the Soviets from attacking us because they knew we could retaliate and blow them up. Why shouldn't that still be the only thing we rely on? And I think if the future were one of a continuation of a standoff, a two-party standoff against a relatively stodgy and stolid and bureaucratic power, such as those who ran the Soviet Union, I think it might well be reasonable for deterrence to be our only option. But unfortunately, also, just looking at the facts, that is not the world we are in, and it's not the world increasingly that we are going to have to live in. People say, well, those who head up countries aren't going to be madmen, and, you know, they're not raving lunatics. They'll realize that if they should attack us, that we would attack them. The problem is not usually raving lunatics. It's that people who head up governments, in some cases, although they may be quite sane and rational in their tactics, they are, from time to time, unfortunately, as Hamlet said of his own feigned madness, mad north by northwest. That is, they are quite careful and rational with respect to a lot of things, but their objectives, ultimately, sometimes, are wholly unreasonable. In the Cuban Missile Crisis, for example, we know from a lot of the material that's followed, both Fidel and Che urged the Soviets to use nuclear weapons. We have two Russian direct witnesses on this. At one point, Che said, "Cuba will perish, but socialism will win." And Soviet Deputy Premier Mikoyan, bless him, said to Che, "We see your readiness to die beautifully, but we believe that it isn't worth dying beautifully." Now, happily, we fought the Cold War principally against the Mikoyans, not against the Che's. But you also have history of, in Europe, two-thirds of a century ago, its most, many people would have said, its most cultivated and educated country fell by constitutional processes into the hands of an individual who was clever, who was quite rational in terms of following his ends, and whose ends were the triumph of the Aryan race, and who, in the near Götterdämmerung in 1945, ordered a massive retreat, what amounted to a death march for huge portions of the German population. You have histories, among the other things that he did. You have histories of a number of national leaders, particularly in totalitarian states, being heavily into the use of drugs. Hitler was, including cocaine and as well as all sorts of other drugs. Mao was a heavy user of barbiturates as well as secanol, we know from his physician. There is a history of some of these folks, including, according to his head of military intelligence, Saddam Hussein, believing deeply in soothsayers. Saddam took two soothsayers with him around during the Gulf War, and one of the reasons that he stuck it out for a time was that they kept telling him he was winning, according to his head of military intelligence. And my favorite quote in this regard is the following about astrology. "A quite serious science. It helps us launch spacecraft and missiles. We use it broadly. Experience shows it is unreasonable to reject it." The author of that is Colonel General Vladimir Yakovlev, the commander-in-chief today of the Russian Strategic Rocket Forces. Now, it is not a sure thing that some one of these individuals or individuals like them are going to use nuclear, or for that matter, bacteriological weapons against the United States in some crazy circumstance. But the possibility at least exists that in the future, since we're going to be dealing with many countries, not with one stodgy bureaucratic power, the possibility exists that a future Saddam Hussein will feel himself emboldened to try such things as seizing a Kuwait or even a Saudi Arabia as a result of his belief that having now nuclear weapons and ballistic missiles of longer and longer range, he can afford to be far bolder. Therefore, I would submit it is worth at least serious study and serious consideration to have some option in dealing with these states that the State Department tells us we can't call rogues anymore. Maybe like Prince, we're supposed to call them states formerly known as rogues. But nonetheless, we ought to have some option, I think, other than deterrence alone. Is the Clinton administration system the right way to go? No, I don't believe it is for the reasons that Sid expressed. For one reason, one of the reasons we're having such trouble with our allies is it leaves our allies unprotected. It would protect only the United States and not do that very well because it would be relatively easily decoyed. I am one who believes that we should seriously investigate this boost phase intercept. This is not something that is alone the province of the right in American politics. People such as Dick Garwin and former senator, and not former senator Joseph Biden, among others, have spoken favorably about the possibility of using boost phase, that is, intercept in the very early 5 minutes or so of an ICBM's flight when it is large, hot, and slow, as distinct from when the Clinton administration system tries to shoot it down later when it is small, cold, and fast. There is a lot of interest, and understandable interest, in exploring boost phase intercept, particularly from the surface of the Earth, say ships near North Korea or sites in eastern Turkey, is one of Dick Garwin's suggestions to deal with a missile coming out of Iraq. Should we look into, do research and development about whether or not such a system could be put in space? Yes, I think so. Should it be focused principally on rogue states such as North Korea, Iran, and Iraq? Yes, I believe so. Should we work together, try to work together with the Russians to do this cooperatively? Yes, I think that's very important. I think there are ways in which we might give Russia an incentive to work with us on this, and we can talk about that as well as the very complex and difficult case of China, perhaps in the questions and answers. Let me close by just saying one thing. After the United States wins a war, this country tends to relax, and if it doesn't see a clear and precise threat on the horizon, it tends to believe that it's made the world safe for democracy and we're never going to have to deal with these problems again. The 1920s and the aftermath of our victory in World War I, the first of the three world wars of this century, the third one being cold, but after we won the first world war, we did that in the 1920s. We relaxed and through most of the 30s and laid back and assumed that nothing really that sour was going to take place. We put a great deal of faith in arms control. We put a great deal of faith in international law. And with one or two important exceptions, we didn't arm ourselves. Carl Vinson did the country a very great service in the 1920s and 1930s by, from his position in the Congress, getting the two-ocean navy built. He didn't know who it was getting built against. He just knew that the United States probably needed a two-ocean navy for protection. I would submit to you that in these good and easy times, after having won a war in which life looks, on the whole, very good, yes, it's a confusing election, and yeah, the stock market went down today, but on the whole, peace and prosperity, the situation is somewhat like that of the 1920s, and that 16 years from now or 32 years from now, many of you, I believe, will look back on those who tried to do what they could to see that the country was defended from some of these still somewhat vague and unclear threats with the same positive attitude that those in the 1940s and 50s looked back with pride in what Carl Vinson was able to do between World War I and World War II. Thank you.
Many thanks to Drs. Drill, Korb, and Woolsey for those comments on national missile defense. Now we have a very large number of questions, and let's get right to them. Several questions have to do with why missile defense as opposed to other approaches to dealing with the problem of proliferation of weapons. So the first one, why bother with national missile defense when any nation has the alternative option of placing a weapon on a ship or ships and sailing it into our major ports? And any of these are addressed, unless I indicate otherwise, to anyone on the panel.
If you can help remove a threat in a credible way that is consistent with diplomacy and the cooperative measures which we all endorsed, and it doesn't break the bank, by all means do that, because we don't know the future.
Other comments?
I very much agree. No one system is going to deal with all possible threats. Ballistic missiles are certainly not the only way anybody could use weapons of mass destruction against the United States, but because today there's no defense against them, every rogue in sight is moving toward getting them, because once they're launched, they more or less are sure of reaching their target. And although there are other things one can do, such as Sid said, smuggle a nuclear weapon in a bale of marijuana, or take other terrorists, or shoot cruise missiles from commercial ships or whatever. There are other possible threats using weapons of mass destruction. What mainly concerns me about ballistic missiles is the possibility of a blackmail threat of the sort that I described if Saddam had had very long-range ballistic missiles and weapons of mass destruction in 1990 and 91, making it harder for the United States and its allies to pull together the coalition that threw him out of Kuwait. And it seems to me for purposes such as that, ballistic missiles are worth looking at defenses against.
Yeah, but the questioner has it just right. We're spending the most money on the least likely thing to happen. We should, if you can do this, fine, but you know, I have my doubts about whether you'll ever get your money's worth on it. And don't forget, if somebody launches a ballistic missile at the United States, it will have a return address, whereas if somebody brings it in a suitcase or something, they won't. So I think it's the least likely, and we've got our priorities wrong, because I didn't see anything in the contract with America that said we have to do all of these other things.
There are a number of questions about why we are not using an approach more along the lines of major arms control initiatives to deal with these threats. In view of strong opposition by both Russian and Chinese governments to Star Wars and amending the ABM treaty, wouldn't drastic reductions in the nuclear arsenals be more effective in reducing the nuclear threat?
You start.
With arms control agreements with Iraq? With Iran? With North Korea? Maybe we can bribe North Korea to stand down its ballistic missile program. We'll call it something else. It's basically a bribe. That's diplomacy and pressure and economic levers. You should use anything that you can. How in the world anybody could think that by reducing levels of American nuclear weapons from the several thousand they are now down to what the Russians appear to want, around 1,500, we're going to have any impact at all on Saddam's work on his own ballistic missiles and weapons of mass destruction? I find that fanciful. It's just not going to have such an effect.
Yeah, but if you take a look at the 1999 Act that says it's the policy of the United States to deploy a national missile defense as soon as it's technologically feasible, they talk about the fact not only from these so-called rogue states, but also accidental launches. And it seems to me that we need to be working to get down the number of missiles around the world. And since the Russians have the most, it would behoove us to get them down. And I can't see any reason for the United States under any circumstances in the world to have more than 1,000 strategic nuclear warheads. And I think if we did that and we unilaterally announced that type of step, it would give us the moral high ground to work with the rest of the world to prevent this proliferation. Because these countries that Jim is talking about, a lot of their technology is going to come from other places in the world, like Russia and China, and countermeasures are going to come from them. And if the United States takes the moral high ground on this, it'll make it less likely that those countries will aid these so-called rogues.
There's a precedent, by the way. It was President Bush, the father, who in 19... What year was it? You remember?
1990
decided that we didn't need all those tactical nuclear weapons in Europe, and they were a danger from the point of view of command and control and safety. And he told Gorbachev, we're going to pull them back. And a week later, Gorbachev came back and said, we're going to pull that out also. It's a good move. I wish we would do it.
I think overall reductions, both the United States and Russia, in numbers of offensive systems are a perfectly reasonable thing to do. But I tell you, reducing your offensive systems and seizing the moral high ground with Saddam Hussein, that and 3 1/4 will get you a cup of cappuccino.
Yeah, but he's not going to get anything if the rest of the world doesn't help him.
Oh, come on. How are you going to keep the North Koreans and the Chinese and the Russian institutes?
They don't have the technology to do this if they don't get outside help. That's the key thing we're talking about here.
But the traffic from outside around among the Russian institutes, the Chinese People's Liberation Army institutes, the Iraqis, the Iranians, the Pakistanis, the North Koreans, these circuits now are trading very heavily in weapons of mass destruction, fissionable material, bacteriological systems, technology for ballistic missiles. It's not the kind of thing that I think, if you're at all hard-headed and realistic about this, Larry, it is not the kind of thing that getting reductions in U.S. and Russian offensive weapons is going to have a lick of effect on.
Well, I disagree, because I think with the Non-Proliferation Treaty, which the world signed in 1970 on two... where countries pledged not to get it. And if you go back and look at what John Kennedy said about how many countries by the turn of the century would have nuclear weapons, we're nowhere near that that number. And that's because of the Non-Proliferation Treaty, which was signed in 1970, in which the rest of the non-nuclear powers said they wouldn't get nuclear weapons if the big powers began to reduce theirs. And we have no earthly reason. We don't have enough targets. I mean, we target 1,800 places in Russia. When you talk to the Russians, they're flattered that we have, you know, 1,800 targets. So even if you buy Jim's argument, we ought to do it to save the money to put into other things like beefing up the border guards and other things that would prevent these terrorists.
I've already said offensive reductions are a perfectly reasonable thing to do, but I'll tell you what happened to the nuclear weapons programs of South Africa and Brazil and Argentina. It wasn't a treaty. It was democracy. What turned those countries away from their nuclear weapons programs was overall international pressure, and they turned into democracies away from the dictatorships, essentially, that they had been before. And the spread of democracy is a wonderful thing from the point of view of reducing access to nuclear weapons, but it is not going to happen anytime soon in some place like Iraq.
If I can take us to a new subject... I think there are a number of, with thanks for your comments, there are a number of people here who wonder whether the missile defense system isn't an offensive system in defensive disguise. A couple questions. Why is national missile defense not openly discussed for what it is? First strike capability. And if we are planning for a missile, quote, defense system, not, quote, offense, why are we considering the reaction of some not-too-friendly countries as we plan for our country's defense? Do we check with them when we induct every new recruit, it says? But I guess the point is, do we check with them about what we do in our defense policy?
I would say in the present context, we're talking about a national missile defense of such limited deployment and such limited capability that coupling it with offense as offense, as we worried about in terms of the balance during the Cold War, is just not right anymore. It's a very limited system, and to the extent that it gives me trouble, it's how you do it, not what you do. It's whether you do it unilaterally and lose cooperation with other countries in the world to try and control proliferation, to try and reduce the nuclear danger or the weapons of mass destruction danger, or not. That's why I feel one does R&D, but one works in a cooperative way. I don't see it as an offense. I just see it as a harmful step. If we do it unilaterally, we lose cooperation from other countries that are important, particularly Russia and China, and we lose opportunities to try and keep the bottle on proliferation.
Yeah, that's fine.
Yeah, I agree.
Sure.
To the panelists who support a national missile defense system, in your opinion, what are the necessary criteria that must first be met before a national missile defense system could be successfully implemented?
I'll say that, it should not be the Clinton administration system. That's one criterion. It should not be mid-course. It should be thoroughly researched and developed in such a way as to be effective and affordable. If it's not both, it shouldn't be done. But should we shy away from doing the research and development because we have this mystical faith that deterrence is always going to work against any and all possessors of ballistic missiles and weapons of mass destruction? I think that would be a bad thing for the country to rely on that kind of mystical faith.
I don't think any of us said you should do that, by the way, either.
Yeah, I mean, we have never stopped doing R&D, as far as I know. We've been doing it when you first started counting there, you know, back in, I guess we started in the 50s, researching it. So we've never stopped.
No.
The real question is, do we deploy? Because when you had the 1999 Act, it made it the policy of the United States to do it. And in this campaign, both candidates more or less committed themselves to deploying. Governor Bush talked about a more robust system than the one that Vice President Gore endorsed. But that's the real issue. Nobody, I think, is arguing against doing research and development.
Oh, sure they are. Much of the research and development that would have been effective to working on boost phase defenses were canceled by the Clinton administration at the beginning of this administration, as were the Rosmamedov talks, which were the negotiations that were started by President Yeltsin in 1992 between the United States and Russia to work cooperatively on missile defenses, the so-called global protection system. Research and development has been very heavily curtailed on the most promising types of things.
It hasn't stopped.
Well,
that's
not
the issue.
All has stopped,
yeah,
but most
we've
promising.
Yeah, but we've spent $100 billion, okay, since Reagan gave that speech on research and development. So when you say it was stopped, it was temporarily cut back to a reasonable level.
The most promising routes have been stopped for the last 8 years.
I would disagree. They were not that promising because the GAO came out with a report on that Brilliant Pebbles and said it was going no place. And I think the Clinton administration did the right thing in the first couple of years by slowing it down.
It's certainly controversial as to how effective the boost phase would be, will be. It's being looked at. But what we did do, rightly or wrongly, in the Clinton administration, was to address the nearest-term threat, because that's what the people were most concerned about, the emergence of a North Korean ballistic missile capability with nuclear warheads. And that can be addressed now in the shortest time with the National Missile Defense. And against a very limited threat, it will have some capability. Whether it's worth it or not, that's a separate question. But we have put our money, and not too sparingly, at the threat that's the most immediate.
The major mistake that was made in 1993, I believe, was twofold. One was cutting off the negotiations with the Russians to work cooperatively. The other was deciding to cut off the most important research and development in 93. And the third mistake was really made in 1996 by pushing for an early deployment of an ineffective system. I think when you put those three mistakes together, the policies of the last 8 years on missile defense have been really quite poor indeed.
You know, it's interesting. In 1996, when the decision was made to move in this direction, there was no debate or complaints from the Republicans in Congress. It was only when this thing didn't work that all of a sudden we came up with these other alternatives. But certainly when the Republicans controlled Congress, they could have funded these particular programs back in 1996 if, in fact, they wanted to.
Well, very little effective management, and I speak as a former general counsel of the Senate Armed Services Committee, very little effective hands-on management of research and development is done from Capitol Hill, Larry, I'll tell you that.
Since we're on politics, let's follow up with a political question. Who are the leading elected officials on the missile defense issue? What will the balance of power look like in the new Congress, where the Republicans will have a razor-thin majority?
I'm a physicist.
Sid, the technical questions are coming next.
Yeah, I have one question. Which administration were you in? Weren't you there when this was going on? I mean, didn't you bring this to the attention of the policymakers?
I was spying. I wasn't making policy.
All right. Who are the leading elected officials, and what will the balance in Congress look like?
Go ahead, Jim.
Well, I think probably the one on the Democratic side who's taken the lead most effectively on the Senate side is Senator Joseph Biden. On the House side, I think there have been several. Ike Skelton from Missouri, Norm Dix from Washington State. All of these are, I think, major participants in the debate, and they don't all agree on everything. On the Republican side, on the Senate, Senator John Kyle has been very active and involved on the House side. I think Congressman Kurt Weldon, those are some of the half dozen or so that have taken the lead in the debate.
I think you're going to see two other senators, one of whom we heard today, Senator Cochran from Mississippi, and Senator Carl Levin
Michigan. First thing I think I've agreed on with you online.
Okay.
I should just say that Senator Cochran gave a speech at lunch at our conference at Stanford in which he indicated very strong commitment on his part and his colleagues to move ahead with the currently conceived missile defense system. Now, Sid, Technical questions. What is the technology of the timeline for a system? How much time will it take to determine a missile has been launched and a defense system to react?
Well, to determine that a system has been launched from our space assets, you're talking about tens of seconds. To depending upon the form of intercept, the form of a system you deploy, if you have a mid-course system like the National Missile Defense, then you have minutes. Remember, the whole trajectory may be 25 minutes. So you would say, scale-wise, 10 minutes. Again, the details are very different for different scenarios. If you're talking about boost phase intercept, well, boosters burn out in anywhere from 3 to 5 minutes, depending upon the particular missile you're talking about, and you're going to have to launch something within a minute, certainly, well within a minute. But you also do have the option that after you've launched, not to give the signal to impact. So you have literally a minute or two.
Sid, so everyone's on the same wavelength. Could you clarify the difference between mid-course and boost phase concepts for national missile defense?
A ballistic missile has the following characteristic. You power an engine, like you see the shuttle take off or you see a missile launch. It's under powered flight, being accelerated up to the speed of something like 6-7 kilometers per second during the burning, several stages of burning. And that can take, as I say, something like 3 to 5 minutes. At the end of that time, the boosters fall away, and you have the reentry vehicle, which is just like a rock falling in space. It's under the influence of gravity, and it goes above the atmosphere on a trajectory which is governed only by the laws of Newton. And that takes from after the first 5 minutes, say, to just a few minutes before reentering the top of the atmosphere, and then you have reentry, where things get slowed down, light decoys get separated from the heavy reentry vehicle by the friction in the atmosphere. The National Missile Defense is mid-course. It's somewhere in the 15-minute, 10 to 15-minute after launch, before landing, the intercept occurs. The boost phase, as I say, is in the first few minutes.
How much money should be spent on proliferation control versus ballistic missile defense systems? More. What sort of proliferation control could we buy for $160 billion?
A lot. Let me say something about Jim's form H. I think we need to spend more on two things. One is the intelligence community. We theoretically don't know how much we spend on it, but you usually see the newspapers speculate on it, and the other is our foreign affairs budget. Our foreign affairs budget is a disgrace. We spend, you know, $14 or $15 billion on the whole foreign affairs, including running the State Department, paying the UN dues, or maintaining our embassies all over the world. We really need to spend more on that. If you do, then, of course, you don't have to spend much on the military. And I would disagree with one other thing on Jim when he said we're relaxed. This is not the 1920s. Today, the United States spends about 40% of the world's total military expenditures. When you add our allies in, we account for 80%. We spend more than all of our adversaries or potential adversaries combined, even if you control for inflation. The budget that was passed this year is 92% of the average we spent on the Cold War. And Bill Clinton will leave office, even if he controls for inflation, spending more money on defense than Dwight Eisenhower, Richard Nixon, Gerald Ford, and Jimmy Carter.
From the point of view of national sacrifice, however, this is the smallest share of the GNP spent on defense since Pearl Harbor. This is a very wealthy economy, so we are spending a good deal of money. But the term, from the point of view of sacrifice of the nation, we are, relatively speaking, I think, relaxed. Now, first of all, I agree with what the first thing Larry said, which is particularly the foreign affairs budget is, I think, badly underfunded. The thing that is important, though, is that funding to stop proliferation, such as Nunn-Lugar money spent in Russia, or whatever we might be able to do across a wide range of nonproliferation activities, to me, is not an alternative to dealing with a potential threat from someone like Saddam. It doesn't matter how much money you spend on nonproliferation. Saddam has the technology for ballistic missiles. He has the technology for bacteriological weapons and quite possibly nuclear. He has smart people. He has oil money. You can spend money on nonproliferation till the cows come home, and it's not going to stop him from doing what he wants to do. There are some governments in the world that are like that, and it is an unfortunate reality, which I think we're going to have to increasingly recognize, even though it's unpleasant.
Let me make a quick comment in support of Jim's former agency, because people rarely do that. I've served on the President's Foreign Intelligence Advisory Board for the past 8 years, and I just want to say that the intelligence challenge to this country to know where the threats are coming from has increased since the Cold War ended. We're not looking at just one big bad guy, and we're not looking at huge facilities making huge numbers of weapons. We're looking at many people who are causes concern. They're dealing with things like biological weapons, chemical weapons, small systems, small numbers. And the value of the intelligence dollar in giving us better knowledge of what's going on in the world is immeasurable. You only hear about occasional failures of the intelligence community. You rarely hear about the important things it does. And I think one should keep that in mind when one looks at the budget for intelligence.
A couple of other questions about alternatives to a ballistic missile defense system. What about the U.S. ability to preemptively strike at a country like North Korea that is moving toward ICBM development? And could the Air Force's airborne laser, although designed for tactical and theater defense, be useful in on-call strategic defense? With regard to the first question, I'm assuming there's some meaning here, like the raid on Osirak.
That's sometimes
like
called pre-boost phase intercept, I think. One of the many reasons why I think ballistic missile defense deserves a fair investigation is so that in a crisis you do not have to guess whether or not someone is going to launch at you and bet Los Angeles or Seattle or whatever on the outcome unless you strike. There was a sort of a chill apothegm that a fellow I knew in the Pentagon in the late 60s used to describe the mindset, I think, which is behind the question, which is offense is defense, defense is offense, weapons that kill people are good, weapons that kill other weapons are bad. I think in the aftermath of the Cold War, we somehow have to get this all turned around and recognize that defense is defense and offense is offense, and that it is not a reasonable alternative to defending ourselves with affordable, if we can make it, and effective, if we can make it, ballistic missile defenses, to say, we'll just blow them up if we think they may be shooting at us. That's way, way, way down the list of what you want to have the president have to consider.
You want the other
question? Other question, could the Air Force's airborne laser, although designed for tactical and theater defense, be useful in on-call strategic defense?
It doesn't sound very practical to me, because it's going to have to be far away on station. And so the operational costs and vulnerabilities of that seem quite forbidding, but it'd take a long time to be more substantive in my answer.
Well, it'd be, I think, very hard in the Mideast, conceivably off Korea. Even then, you got to stay on station, probably pretty close to North Korea, and you're vulnerable because there's a big airplane up there. It's not really what you want. It's a battlefield system. It's not what you want to use for a strategic defense.
Exactly right.
What effect will recent overtures by President Putin to drastically reduce nuclear weapons and to proceed with START 3, regardless of ABM, have on the missile defense timeline and debate, particularly with regard to China? I'm not sure I understand the last part of the question, but the first part stands on its own.
I welcome President Putin saying, let's talk about reducing the forces. Mm-hmm. I think we said that before about decoupling with ABM. I really don't know what he said. We raised that question in the discussion this afternoon. Was Putin talking about really modifying the ABM treaty and cooperatively doing something on strategic missile defense, or was it only for theater or short-range missile defense? And there were two views on that, and I frankly don't know what he said.
He and his foreign minister, Ivanov, have said it one or two times somewhat vaguely within the last couple of 3 months, things that suggest they might be interested in Dick Garwin, Joe Biden-type ideas for boost phase intercept from the surface in near rogue states such as Iraq or Iran or North Korea. At other times, he seems to be talking about theater missile defense, that is, being able to protect southern Russia from Iraq, let's say. And it's very hard to sort it out. I think we ought to exert every effort, both by working on mutual offensive reductions and by responding to even vague overtures of that sort, to work with the Russians as much as we can and to try to get back into the approach of 1992, which was canceled in 1993, namely President Yeltsin's proposal that we work on this together.
I think we all agree on that.
Yep.
We have reached the time where we have time for just one more question, and it is, the ideological divide on this issue reminds me of the Grand Canyon. Is there any basis for compromise? How would Governor Bush unite America on this divisive issue?
By keeping it in research and development until it works.
Agree with that. By exploiting his landslide, I don't know.
You got the answer.
Sid, any last words?
No, I agree with both statements.
I only have one final comment. When Jim started talking about the astrologer, I thought he was going to mention Reagan. And
Nancy was an amateur compared to Saddam.
I'd like to thank Dr. Sidney Drell of Stanford University, Dr. Larry Korb of the Council on Foreign Relations, former CIA Director Jim Moolsey for their great exploration of this topic tonight and explanation of many of the complexities of the issue. I'd like to thank you all for your excellent questions to pose to the panel. Now, this meeting of the Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley is adjourned.
Thank you, James.